You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody. Bill,
I was a little late starting, Matt. I apologize. I'm becoming an official New Englander this week because I have tapped my own maple tree in my front yard, and I had to reattach my bucket to the spout, and that slowed
this
me down.
This is sounding kind of dirty, Bill. I don't know if this is a euphemism for something else or what, but okay.
No, I've actually what I have tapped is a tree in my front yard. Which if you have a maple tree in your yard, it is your obligation to tap the tree, even though it's I don't know if you know the particulars of sugaring, Matt Lewis, but
I do actually. But for those out there who don't, please,
you need to collect 40 gallons of sap to create 1 gallon of syrup. So.
39 and a half is usually industry standard.
Oh, you're bringing it today, aren't you?
40 for the layman, yeah.
Now, what I have on my property is a red maple. A red maple is not your typical sugaring tree because once the buds appear, the sap starts to taste bad. So you have a limited window of time when you can actually tap it. So I will probably get about 5 gallons of sap, which would result in 1 pint of syrup. But syrup's expensive. These are as Donald Trump has told me, we're in a mess. I gotta scrimp and save wherever I can. So here I am homesteading my maple syrup. But that left me a little bit.
Will you be jarring later? Do you know about this jarring?
Oh, sure. I live in Western Massachusetts, Matt Lewis.
My grandmother used to do, she would jar stuff, like beets and stuff. And people I know, relatives of mine, have cellars, like outside. Yeah. They have like these ground cellars where they'll keep cans and potatoes and stuff.
Yep.
It's pretty wild, man. This is the fourth turning, my friend. Are you familiar with the book?
I haven't read the book. When I was younger, and I had a bit of, we are Generation Xers. I had a bit of a fascination with the concept of a Generation X. And those authors, Strauss and Howe, wrote a couple of, was it 13th Gen, if I remember correctly, which was one of the, there were a handful of sort of defining Generation X books, and they did one of them.
I think it was called Generations.
Might be right.
Say that we're the 13th, yeah.
Although I've read more, I know you've been talking about the fourth turning, and Steve Bannon's very fond of the fourth turning. I've read other commentary that the fourth turning is kind of mumbo jumbo. It's a subscribing this sort of certitude to cyclical history that isn't really there. But if nothing else, it affects Bannon's thinking, and therefore it makes it relevant.
Right. Exactly. My friend Jamie Weinstein just had him on. Strauss is dead, I believe. That's the guy who was from the Capitol Steps. Very familiar with
the Capitol Steps, yes. The Washington's own Weird Al troupe.
And then Hal was the one who was on Jamie's podcast, so check that out, the Jamie Weinstein Show.
I also apologize I wasn't here last week. Usually it's because you're gallivanting around the world that we have to take a week off, but it was me this time who...
So last week we were out. I didn't feel like there was a lot of clamoring for us. That bothered me.
People may have other sources of information analysis to turn to in times of dire need.
Busy week too. There was stuff breaking, and we weren't there.
Well, perhaps that's on us. Perhaps that's our fans saying, "Hey, you weren't here when I needed you. I'm going to go turn now to some other fly-by-now, some viral post on Medium to get what I need and forget you." But hopefully the fans are loyal enough.
Could we have sent them into the arms of Tommy Lauren? or someone such as that? Is that or do they go?
You,
did they
you
go
think
to David Fromm and Bob? I mean, I don't know where they went. But
you think very little of our fans. Or you think that's where they're going?
It's unclear to me. All I know is I did not see a lot of concern. But Bill, you had a good excuse for being out. I intentionally did not talk to you. We did not debrief about what you did or how it went because I wanted to do it here. So, Dish.
Well, I delivered a speech at the DNC winter meeting. I was invited by the Association of State Democratic Chairs. Those are all the state party chairs. So they have their own organization, and they meet within the DNC meeting. So this is the meeting where they elected Tom Perez chair on Saturday. I spoke before then on the Thursday during their general business meeting. I didn't get to stick around for the actual vote, unfortunately, but I did fly out on Wednesday and flew out on Friday, and I got to talk to some state party chairs and got to sort of get a feel of the hotel. I mean, this all happening in a Atlanta hotel ballroom, the vote. And people commented this is very unlike any other DNC meeting because it was like its own convention. There were literally signs everywhere. Lots of, you know, young volunteers handing out pamphlets, lots of, you know,
this is Ellison and Perez were the two, I guess, the two big names there.
Two big, but the also-rans were very active in the halls too, even though they didn't get a lot of votes. But, I can't pronounce anybody's name, but Buttigieg, the South Bend, the young South Bend, Indiana mayor, he had a pretty active team. Even some that didn't even have very much support at all, like J. Rue Green, I think her name is. You know, I saw her people out and about, and lots of glossy paper floating around, trying to scratch whatever votes they could. I'd be having breakfast with a couple state party chairs, and I mean, it wasn't just the chair; it was vice chair and secretary and treasurer. So people be swirling around all the time, trying to talk about, you know, who support they have, who they need to get. People going from breakfast table to breakfast table, trying to scratch them a few votes. So it was interesting being, you know, on the periphery of all that, and you know, I actually wasn't quite sure what I was going to say when I was asked to speak. I was given no guidelines what I could say. When I speak, you know, I don't like to take like an off-the-shelf speech and just give something that doesn't fit the moment or the audience. I try to get a sense of what that audience wants to hear. And I didn't quite know what the tenor of the room was going to be as I was flying in. But when I got there, I got a very strong sense that there's a lot of anxiety, a lot of concern that whatever happened in the Saturday vote, there was going to be lingering tensions and divides. And so I felt comfortable talking about that very candidly with I don't want to make people feel terrible about their situation. but what I basically did was I point out that, you know, Democrats love to kind of self-flagellate and quote Will Rogers. I'm not a member of an organized political party. I'm a Democrat. And I mentioned that came out of the aftermath of the 1924 convention, known as the Klan Bake, when the pro and anti-KKK forces battled it out on the floor, and there were 103 ballots before nominating a presidential candidate, the most ever.
Wow!
But there's a long history of Democratic division going back to, you know, not even counting, you know, Civil War Democratic divides, but, you know, the late 19th century, William Jennings Bryan, the populist versus the more conservative Bourbon Democrats, led by Grover Cleveland, and, you know, which is very analogous to what's going on today. But there's just as significant a history of Republican division. There, you know, in 1881, one Republican faction member murdered the president from the other faction.
What?
And, that's the James Garfield assassination. That's the James Garfield assassination. James Garfield was from the reformist wing of the Republican Party. The more machine side, the stalwarts, were, you know, Chester Arthur, who was the vice president, he came from the stalwart wing. There was Charles Gittow, the assassin, was clearly not all there, but was a devout stalwart and was trying to get a job in the administration and was getting shut out. And so he killed the president.
That's right.
and then said, I'm the stalwart of the stalwarts. And, you know, you fast forward 30 years later, you know, Teddy Roosevelt literally walks out of the convention and starts a brand new party across the street. I mean, that's division. And then you can fast forward to today and say, 2 years ago, Republicans had a speaker who had to quit so he could keep the government open. I mean, that's how divided the Republican Party has been. And you still divide today in the party over what to do about health care, what to do about taxes, what to do about immigration. So it's not like these divisions don't exist, even though they win elections. So my point to the room
was... Did you make those points
that
in the speech?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
And so my end point was, like, look, it's not unusual to have division in a two-party system. You're going to have disparate factions within those parties. It's not like in Europe, in a parliamentary system, we have 20 parties and everyone can choose their little ideological cocoon to stay in on election day. And then it's up to those who get elected to work out the compromises. In America, the compromises get hashed out ahead of the vote. And a lot of voters don't like what gets hashed out because it's not their purest belief. But that's the deal. It's a party chair's job to manage that. That's part of the history of the job. And I ended on, and then I talked about how there's clearly a sense a lot of primaries are coming. That's got people on edge, but primaries can be fine if they're just, you know, good faith debates about direction of the party and everyone comes together at the end. What's not fine is if someone's trying to launch a purge strategy, because you can't purge your way to success. You're cutting off an arm. And I quote at the very end Jesse Jackson in 1988, who is, you know, no squish, but he had said, this is after the primary, he came in second to Mike Dukakis, there were some hard feelings, but he said, left wing, right wing, you need both wings to fly, we're all a bird living in the same environment, and when we bring the wings together, like in 1964 with Lyndon Johnson, he said the thesis, the antithesis, and the creative synthesis. Then we win. You know, 1976, Jimmy Carter. We brought the wings together and we won. When we divide, like in 1968 or 1980, we lose. When we unify, we win. So I got some feedback from members who were, you know, I think, you know, Hillary leaners and folks who are Bernie leaders, who appreciated that message. So we'll see if that actually gets put into play. I mean, clearly Ellison and Perez had a deal worked out where whoever won, the other person would get offered a deputy position and try to keep the party unified. So that's clearly the message from the top. But the rumblings from the Ellison supporters are still there, and you still got folks who are chomping at the bit to launch primary challenges. And so that may still come to bear.
Well, it sounds like a really good message, the fact that you could put it together quickly, sort of sensing what the audience needed to hear, the fact that you had the command of the facts and the historical knowledge is really good. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that, you know, whether it's received well at the time or not, it sounds like you really tailored the speech toward what they needed to hear at that moment.
I appreciate that. But having talked about some of the Democratic divisions, perhaps we should shift to what's going on the Republican side. I mean, you wrote after Trump's speech on Tuesday that I think you wrote, and I know you talked about it on CNN, that this was Trump's one of his strongest speeches. Clearly, he's got a sense of how he can better communicate what he wants to do. But then I read another column by Jonathan Burstein at Bloomberg that said, look, governing is about choices, and there are no choices in this speech. You can give any direction to the party what to do on health care, what to do on taxes, and they're clearly divided about that stuff, and they'll still be divided when this is all over. And now you have, on top of all this, what's going on with Jeff Sessions, so it seems like whatever momentum you get out of that speech, it's already gone.
So I do think it was a very good speech. Just so different from the inaugural. You know, he's had two big speeches since he's been president, essentially. One's the inaugural speech, which was very much playing to his base, very much not attempting to be unifying or optimistic. And I think this speech was much more of a normal speech. He's keeping his promises by and large, but But the style, the delivery, the just it was a much more normal speech. I think it was a very good speech, and clearly different people wrote them, you know, or different a big different emphasis. I would disagree with the criticism that it doesn't solve any problems. Like, I don't think that's what this speech is supposed to do necessarily. I think it did broadly lay out his vision. I don't know that he needs to get in the weeds or that this is the proper or appropriate venue to get involved in, like, the internecine squabbles over, like, you know, yeah, we're going to have tax reform, but should there be a border adjusted tax or not? And is, you know, like, that, I don't think that's really the place to have that out. I think it's, you know, I think he did really good. And of course, I think there it's entirely likely that the Sessions story came out to dampen some of the positive reviews that were coming out of that speech. I doubt if it's, maybe it's a coincidence, but it does strike me as interesting that on the heels of that very good speech, which I think was largely, you know, got a lot of positive attention and praise, that the Sessions story then, you know, came out so quickly after that.
Are you suggesting there was something planned there?
Yeah, I suspect that this, you know, it doesn't mean that it's not a concerning issue, but I suspect that the release of this information was timed to dampen the momentum that Trump was getting after that speech.
So on our manometer. After that speech, you know, maybe you were leaning more towards Teddy Roosevelt or Ronald Reagan. After what's happened with Sessions, are we kicked back to more Warren Harding or Richard Nixon?
Oh, man, I guess I'm at TR. This Sessions thing, I think this Sessions thing is probably blown out of proportion. I understand why it is. Like, I think the larger Russian story does trouble me. I think it's entirely possible that Sessions was just having these very normal meetings with the Russian ambassador, and it's entirely possible that other people, you know, Flynn, Stone, Bannon, were doing Manafort were doing back channel stuff with the Russians. Like, that's possible. I'm giving Sessions, I think, the benefit of the doubt here when he was questioned by Al Franken. It just didn't strike me like he was intentionally misleading or lying. And so, you know, that's kind of where I come down on it. But I think it's probably a nothing burger. But I do think he probably, I mean, I think it's appropriate for him to recuse himself of anything, since he was a surrogate. I don't think that's an admission of guilt or anything like that. I just think it's an appropriate thing to do. But I do think the talk about him resigning are overwrought.
Well, even if you're dubious about the severity of what Sessions did, it certainly feels like the whole Russian element in the Trump campaign is a matter that's not going away. There's clearly lots of threads to pull. There's clearly people who are investigating and people who are willing to leak about what's being investigated. And if that's going to be a drip, drip, drip throughout the entire presidency, you know, wouldn't that put you more in a Harding or Nixon camp, or do you think that you just don't believe there's gonna at the end gonna be that much there?
Well, number one, we don't know what happened. I've always thought it was weird that Donald Trump was so rhetorically pro Putin and pro Russia, but I don't think that, you know, I don't think that meeting, that talking to Russia, meeting with Russia, as I wipe my nose here glamorously, I don't think that that's in this day and age a smoking gun. Like, I think that you would need to have evidence that the Trump campaign was coordinating with Russia to defeat Hillary Clinton, and even then. No, look, if that happened, I think that would be, in my opinion, despicable and disqualifying. But I don't even know what that would do. Like, if that's illegal, if I don't think that turns a lot of Trump's base against him. Like, I so So I guess my point is, all this stuff about Russia, it's going to keep coming. I think the media thinks that this is going to be like a Watergate moment, that at some point it's going to there's going to be a tipping point, and it's going to be a huge scandal, and Trump is going to be forced out and you know, ignominy and all that. I'm not so sure that that's true. But what do you think?
Well, I have two thoughts about this. One, I think there is a lot of there. I mean, I don't know if it actually is going to amount to convictions, but there's clearly a story to be told, whether across a legal boundary or not, what really happened, what were these contacts with Russians about during the campaign. You're starting to see more and more talk about, was there direct Russian involvement in the drafting of the platform in July that recommended being soft on Russia regarding Ukraine? Does that violate the law if they did that? Is that a Logan Act violation? I'm not totally sure if it was technically a violation, would be prosecuted. I don't know, but people wouldn't like it. I don't think it would look very good. And if nothing else, this is definitely soaking up a lot of time and energy in an administration that's already very behind in actually doing stuff. They are stunningly behind in just literally staffing the administration. They're 517 people, 517 posts, key posts that require Senate confirmation out of about 550 that Trump hasn't even named a person for yet. And you have these big outstanding sticking points with tax reform, with healthcare, that it's not clear whether they can be resolved in a way that actually you can cobble up enough votes to get it through the Congress. And every day lost to just, you know, getting cabinet people confirmed and sub-cabinet people confirmed is days lost on the Senate floor. So time spent, you know, putting out Russian fires also is just distracting. So I think that's a big problem for them. My caveat for that is this thing I talked about in the Obama days. I have a general belief that scandal politics does not directly benefit the opposition party in raw electoral gain. You can go back to Iran-Contra or Whitewater or Abu Ghraib or Salinger or Fast and Furious. You know, these things did not, you know, George H.W. Bush still won the presidency after Iran-Contra. Bill Clinton got reelected after all the Whitewater stuff. George Bush got reelected after Abu Ghraib, Salinger, Fast and Furious. That stuff didn't drag down Obama and his reelection. I believe that generally speaking, voters look at that stuff as playing political games and not caring about what affects me and my pocketbook. Not that Democrats shouldn't talk about it at all. I'm not suggesting that. I think there is a crude political value in distracting and gumming up the works for those in power. But you can't assume that is sufficient to get the pendulum to swing back. You better put some legwork into what is your policy agenda that you're going to bring to the voters in the midterms. If you neglect that, I think you risk big problems.
Yeah, I think it's natural for people to want, like, oh my gosh, we lost power. We have to get it back quick. What's the easiest way to get it back? Say Obama's obviously not a, you know, not legitimate president. That'll fix it, you know. Or Trump has this thing with Russia. I mean, our whole generation, going back to the Strauss-Howe thesis. I mean, our whole generation has been so influenced probably by Watergate, you know. And that
Watergate scandal jackpot. I mean, that is, everyone wants their Watergate. Yeah. We actually bring it. Not only bring a president down, but, you know, unlike Teapot Dome, where Warren Harding died before that really broke big. But when it did break big, Calvin Coolidge was seen as the guy who cleaned it up, and it didn't help Democrats that Teapot Dome was exposed. Watergate, because Gerald Ford pardoned Nixon and tainted himself with it, whether that was the right or wrong thing to do at the time, it was a bad political move that helped Democrats win in 1976. So that's the dream that you have when you chase these things. But that is the exception to how scandal politics typically plays out. Now maybe because not just because of the scandal murmuring, but because the legislative agenda stalls, and maybe there's some economic problems by 2018, who knows, Democrats have a better-than-expected midterm. Maybe they could actually take back the House and the Senate. You know, stranger things have happened. And if that happens, the investigations into Trump get supercharged. And you could even...
Oh, yeah, then you really could. I mean, you could have an impeachment if Democrats... I think you probably would have an impeachment if Democrats controlled the House. That's where it's at.
But if you did... You know, it doesn't mean that Pence is Gerald Ford. Pence could be Calvin Coolidge. Pence could be the guy who's insulated from all this, who cleans house, runs a tighter ship, and yeah. coast into 2020. So it's not a given that that impeachment move was a smart move for Democrats.
And it's great that Pence is completely out of the loop on everything, because he's got plausible deniability, as we talked about.
Let's see if there's any more there. You know, I think Nate Cohen of the Times pointed out that the way to really he called this fan fiction. He wasn't saying it was really going to happen. But Democrats take back Congress 2018. You make Hillary Clinton Speaker, which you can do. It's just you have to be a member of Congress to be Speaker. You impeach both Trump and Pence, and then you have President Hillary Clinton. If you actually could tar Pence with anything, you know, people might talk about that more.
Well, not only is it politicians who have been, influenced by the Watergate promise. But I think it's obviously impacted journalists as well. And I just listened to a really great podcast with Ben Dominic and Jonah Goldberg at The Federalist. And Jonah made a really interesting point. Ben was making the point, which I agree with, that so much of what we think is like liberal bias is also could be explained by bias for clicks and excitement and page views. And Jonah made a point, which I think is true, that a lot of these stories on Trump, like let's say the session story, should be like a level 6 story. Like, it's bad, but let's not freak out yet. But there's an incentive for us all to punch up our writing and to make every story seem like it's a big deal. I mean, that's what good writing is nowadays, you know, partly. It's hyping things. And so, but that's sort of contributing to the sense that the media is out to get Trump and that the media gets it wrong, is this desire to take stories that are maybe worrisome or troubling, but not there yet. We don't have enough information to say it's a big deal. And then you have like the New York Times and the Washington Post putting out these stories, and then the initial cable news reaction is to sort of like, wow, this is like the you know, Saturday Night Massacre or whatever it was, or this is, you know, and then you end up a couple of days later with like, well, not really, not exactly, not quite as bad as we thought it might be.
Well, that's the risk with like just Democratic resistance to Trump altogether. If you get overheated about everything.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like the speech, you know, Trump shows up and doesn't drool on himself, and it's good boy, you used your indoor voice, so you gave a nice speech. There is a risk of setting the bar way, way too low if these things don't pan out at all. There's clearly there's enough going on with the Russia stuff where I think people feel like, you know, it's worth pulling these threads. This is not some, you know, crazy wild goose chase. Something went on here, whether, you know, how bad it was, you can't know, but it's not nothing.
I'm really amazed at how we've gotten past Russia. And I basically never quit fearing or hating Russia, like, honestly. That's like American apple pie and everything to me. But a lot of people on the left never really hated Russia. You know what I mean? Like, some of them are fellow travelers, but I'm amazed by how many people on the right, and I'm not talking about fringe right. I mean, people that I know that like voted for Bush and Reagan who are like, oh yeah, we need to get along with Russia. I hope he's getting along with Russia. You know, I've been really surprised. Old people who lived their whole lives in the Cold War, who who tell me like, oh, he needs to get along with them. That's the last thing we need is trouble with Russia. I'm like, where does this come from? Like, did you not watch the Rambo movies that I watched as a kid or Red Dawn or whatever?
Or America with Chris Christopherson?
There you go. Or the Americans, for that matter.
Well, yeah, I wrote about...
So like, I guess my larger point here is that I don't know that there's a... Like, so Democrats all of a sudden now are very worried about Russia. I mean, after Obama basically lets them take Crimea and doesn't do anything, all of a sudden now Democrats want to scare us about Russia. And maybe we should be. I mean, look, I'm still like I've never quit. Like, I've never given up on the Cold War personally. That's just me. But I don't know if they can make fetch happen. Like, I don't know. I get this sense that like I don't think there's like this, despite years and years of movies and pop culture. For some reason, I think so many Americans are like over the Russia thing. There's no Red Scare left, man.
Well, I talk to friends on the left all the time that say, "What's wrong? Why are these conservatives mad about Russia? Don't they hate Russia? We've always hated Russia." But what
the other side of the hypocritical coin?
Well, right? And I remember when I wrote about the America miniseries for Politico back in January, I talked about this. I mean, what in the Cold War days, the fear of Russia was fear that communism would destroy the American way of life. Now, on the right, the fear of destroying our way of life comes from radical Islam or cultural liberal elites. It's not from communism. Russia's not communist anymore. If anything, Russia is seen as
right, Bill.
On Soviet our
Union,
side.
The Soviet Union was defeated.
What's that?
I'm sorry.
So
you actually believe that communism and the Soviet Union were defeated, like when the Berlin Wall fell, that this isn't a big ploy, that they've been underground all this time, being led by a KGB
That's a hardcore long game you got in your mind there, but
biding their time.
I think the average conservative is saying, Russia's not communist anymore. They may be oligarchs, they may be authoritarian, but they're not communist. They're not going to, if anything, they're on my side when it comes to fighting radical Islam, and they're even on my side when it comes to defeating cultural liberalism. I think it's a secondary point for
that. But their economic philosophy was never my primary reason for hating them. I mean, you know what I mean? That was part of the package. But I think you're obviously right. But I always was concerned about the authoritarianism and the.
But there's little argument that even if Putin, ruled the roost on his side of the globe, that he was going to make America totalitarian if Trump is allied with him. There isn't that. Now, obviously, people on the left are saying, "Wait a second, they just sullied our democracy for Pete's sake." But on the Republican side, I don't think they look at it that way. They say, "Hey, he sided with my guy. We had a free and fair election. And if Russia is going to do what they do in their country with their neighbors, who cares? That doesn't affect my way of life." Now on the Democratic side, I quibble with you on Obama's and the Democratic approach to Russia. I think there remains a belief in diplomacy in general. Democrats believe it in diplomacy with almost anybody. They want diplomacy with Iran. They want diplomacy with the Palestinians. So saying that we want diplomacy with Russia, even if we are concerned about Putin's authoritarianism, that's not discordant. And there was a general belief, which I think accurately, that, hey, we need Russia's cooperation with terrorism. We need Russia's cooperation with Iran. We need Russia's cooperation with Libya when that was a hot issue. So it doesn't make sense to use the Romney framework and say, this is our greatest geopolitical foe. We shouldn't really talk to them very much. That doesn't get us anywhere.
But I will say it. I don't like to score cheap points against Obama and George W. Bush. Like, let's be fair. He stood by and allowed Russia to Putin and to grow an influence. And
you saw Putin's soul with his own two eyes.
I know. I like the John McCain saw KGB. But Obama was president for the last 8 years, and like I really believe that Putin looked at Obama and said, "This guy is a wimp. This guy, he thinks we can negotiate." Like, I think Putin totally played him using his KGB Jedi mind tricks, and not only did he roll into Crimea, but he attempted to defeat Obama's party. And Obama basically let it happen.
Well, I would characterize the 8 years a little differently. You know, when Obama came in, Putin wasn't in charge. It was Medvedev. I mean, you might argue he was behind the scenes.
Right.
But there's a key point here. The reset was about resetting with Medvedev. And the pinnacle of that strategy was the UN resolution on Libya, where Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, successfully got Russia to abstain from that resolution, that's the kind of thing that Russia would reflexively veto. If America wants to do it, we're gonna do the opposite. They successfully persuaded Russia, hey, we're going to get a multinational coalition against Gaddafi. This is not America, trying to get into your turf or your neighborhood. We're not trying to encircle you. You can abstain from this, and it's going to be okay. Medvedev agrees with that, and reportedly Putin did not. So there was actual distance between Medvedev and Putin. And Putin wasn't pulling the strings at that moment, but he was mad about it. And if it wasn't already his plan, it was a further incentive to run again for office. I think if it was a year later, I think it was in a year. So at the end of the day, the reset didn't work, but it's not a straight line. There was a point where it was working. And then when Putin came back in, there was legitimate concern in the Obama administration, but they didn't want to take an excessive hard line because they did need their cooperation with Iran, which they got. It's not like they got nothing out of those talks. They did. And they were doing that at the same time that Crimea was going on.
They got their cooperation to get a bad deal, and also don't forget about Syria.
Well, it's all happening at the same time. So, I mean, this is an enormously complicated situation they were in. If you want to argue that they played the hand badly, that's fine. But I think it's oversimplifying to say they just got rolled. There are things that Obama wanted to get that he did get in that arrangement. And even with Crimea, obviously no one's happy that Putin stimulated Crimea, except for maybe Donald Trump, because he kind of shrugged his shoulders at it. They did draw a line at the rest of Ukraine and succeeded in that. There was some concern that Putin was going to keep going, and they didn't. So I don't think it's fair to say they literally did nothing. There was a global rallying that Obama led to say, hey, you can't go any farther here. Syria, obviously, that diplomacy did not work out. So I'm not going to argue that this was like, an A-plus situation, but it was a very complicated situation, and it's not correct to say that it was like a total bust either, because there's things that Obama set out to get that he did get.
Well, in any event, I guess my main point is, and I think you're right about the reasons, whether they're rational or not, that Americans don't really care about Russia anymore.
There's a red-blue divide here. On the blue side, people care a lot right now. But I agree with you that it's not, it's not uniform.
Yeah, but he's got the blue. You can't win. Even he needs to get more than blue to win. Unless they do stumble across a major, scandal through investigations, independent prosecutors, that kind of thing, subpoena power, and then who knows? But I still don't. I still wonder. Like, let's say that there was a tape of Paul Manafort, who at the time would have been, let's say, campaign manager, talking with a Russian operative, saying like, "Hey, can you release this WikiLeaks stuff next week? We're going to need it to take down Hillary." Like, let's say that came out. New York Times, Washington Post, cable news, all that, right? Then what? Like, they have some commission to look into it, or you know, I mean, like, I just don't know what would happen if that did come out. Like, the Logan Act has never, I don't think, has ever been actually used. Maybe Paul Manafort is like convicted under the Logan Act. I mean, one guy, a scalp. I don't know. Like, I don't know what happened.
I want to shift one other topic before I have to go, and that is, you wrote about tax reform this week at the Daily Beast, and I know this is not as exciting as talking about Russia and scandal, but I'm really fascinated by the border adjustment debate that's going on right now. And, you know, because, you know, Paul Ryan wants to do major tax reform, which Obama tried to do and couldn't get done, because the problem with tax reform is that once you are messing with the tax code, particularly on the corporate side, there are inevitably winners and losers speak up, and therefore you can't do a deal. So Ryan, who wants to cut corporate taxes, wants to cut personal taxes, but he wants to do it through budget reconciliation, which is the process that circumvents the possibility of a filibuster, so you don't need to get any Democratic votes. To do that, it can't increase the deficit. He wants it to be revenue neutral, and in his telling, the only way to make it revenue neutral is through this border adjustment provision in which businesses can deduct their exports, but they can't deduct costs from imports, which is the reverse of where it is today. And manufacturers think this is great because it's a de facto subsidy for manufacturing. And the retailers think it's horrible because they're going to pay taxes on all the goods that they import. Ryan is trying to say, one, hey, retailers, it's not going to be that bad because the dollar is going to strengthen. And what you do make is, you know, the dollars you keep will have greater value, and it's all going to be a wash. And number two, as a budgetary matter, it's a revenue raiser, and therefore it allows me to put this to reconciliation, which allows me to do tax reform at all. And if I can't get this, I can't do tax reform. So a lot of the House seems to be on board with this, but the Senate Republicans are not. Trump has given mixed signals, and the retailers have put out a really brilliant ad, which I believe is going to be on Saturday Night Live this weekend. It already ran on Fox and Friends, which has done like the OxyClean Billy Mays ads, talking about the bat tax, how the bat tax is your everything tax that taxes everything, your car, your clothes, your medicine, your food. And you know the right better than I do, but from my understanding, once you label something a tax, conservatives immediately hate that thing. So I feel like the retailers are playing this really well. They can whip up sentiment against the bat tax, a nice catchy tax name. You might sink all of tax reform.
I like the bat tax name. I don't know anymore. I mean, according to the old rules, you'd be totally right. It'd be dead on arrival. Yeah, you're right. I mean, there was this Martin Feldstein had a Wall Street Journal op-ed saying that border adjustment tax causes the value of the dollar to rise, offsetting the tax. That's awful complicated. You know right. what I'm saying? It's a weird thing. Now, but I guess the point of this would be that Ryan wants to do it through reconciliation, so you wouldn't need the 60 votes or whatever in the Senate. Is that the rationale?
That's my understanding.
Okay. It'll be interesting to see. I mean, this does divide. That my argument was that they should just go for the tax cuts. But because it would at least this my argument was that in Trump's speech that's what he should talk about, the, you know, corporate tax cuts and per individual tax cuts. I don't know what's going to happen with this. I like the ad idea. It's going to be a test as to like what has happened to the right and the Republican Party. Like, do they support this tax? If Paul Ryan wants it too, that could give it a certain amount of cover. I'm interested that the House is more for it than the Senate too. Like, why are House Republicans more on board? Is it just the Paul Ryan influence? The Freedom Caucus has to be against this, right? I mean, the Club for Growth is strongly against the bat tax.
I haven't heard much. I could have missed that. I'm not sure if the Freedom Caucus has a clear stance on it yet. I've just generally heard that the Senate Republicans have great resistance to it. And Paul Ryan went over there and basically made a direct pitch and told them, you know, keep your powder dry. And then Tom Conner went right on the Senate floor and sort of subtweeted Ryan and said, I'm not going to keep my powder dry. I'm not going to keep my mouth shut for a terrible idea. I mean, Ryan, you know, bless his heart. I disagree with Ryan on pretty much everything, but I respect the fact that he actually tries to govern. He actually tries to come up with things that can actually have some semblance of passing, even if they, you know, violate his purest Ayn Rand principles. But every time he tries to do that, he gets smacked upside the head. I don't know.
I'm skeptical of this magical notion that putting a tax on something won't matter because somehow it's going to cause the dollar to rise and it's going to all even out anyway. It's a no-brainer. Like, it's free money. Like, doesn't it just seem kind of magical to think that that there aren't going to be other, like, unintended consequences?
Well, that's the tough thing. I mean, you could argue in a vacuum that nothing else in the world changes. This action would strengthen the value of the dollar, but you don't know what else is going to occur in the world, particularly with Donald Trump at the helm. The other things he might do that could weaken the value of the dollar, and the plans don't work out as designed. So I understand the skepticism there, but to do the tax cut strategy that you lay out, that's what Bush did. I'm just cutting taxes. Who cares? You know, Dick Cheney, deficits don't matter. Just cut them. Hand out checks. Put your name on them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm obviously for like entitlement reform, for example. I mean, that's something that Trump's against, you know. So
right, but Ryan might force that issue too. We don't know yet, but that's a possible. Yeah. There's some rumblings there that look, President proposes, Congress disposes. We can put the Trump budget is some military increase, gut domestic spending, leave Social Security, Medicare alone. And the House Republicans are saying, even your domestic spending cuts are too much for us. You can't just decimate everything. And you're only doing that because you won't touch Social Security and Medicare, which we think is a budgetary imperative. Ryan may cause a showdown with Trump over that. And that puts a lot of pressure on Trump to say, look, am I going to have a fight with my own party over this stuff or not? So far, he's trying to keep the party together, more or less. And governing is hard. To expand on what Trump said, and this is more complicated than you might have thought coming in.
Yeah, I should have read my column about Obamacare. I always thought that there was a pretty good chance that at some point Trump would like sell out and triangulate and like cut deals with Schumer. That doesn't seem like as likely anymore, does it? Like, Schumer's trying to take him out, trying to take him down. Like, so I guess Trump is going to have to stick with the right. He's not going to be able to go to the, sort of go against Washington, against Republicans and Democrats and cut deals with
Schumer. I mean, Trump would have to move pretty far at this point. I mean, there is such animus on the left to Trump right now that anything seen as giving him a lifeline would be very politically difficult for most Democrats to
right. do. Right. So even if they were going to cut a deal that ideologically they're close on, like an infrastructure bill that gave a lot of money to, let's say, Democratic special interests or whatever, why would Schumer want to give him a win and give him like work with him on something and change
the system? You have 10 Senate Democrats, so you have 11 Senate Democrats from states that Trump won. So you had someone to work with. So it's not just like with Schumer, you could do the deal with Manchin, and Manchin could try to bring, a handful of other Democrats along. But to the extent that you are losing Republican votes for these compromises, you need to get even more Democrats on board. Presumably any deal like that's not going to bring a unified Republican caucus along, particularly in the House. So I think that would require, and Trump may be the kind of guy thinking, 6 months down the line, I'll do my little jiu-jitsu and I'll change the narrative. It'll be season two of Celebrity White House, and I'll make that pivot. I don't think he.
Omarosa's right. Chief of staff in this right. scenario.
But if he is actually thinking in that way, I don't think he appreciates how much that well has been poisoned on the left. I mean, it would have to be something that was so demonstrably good for people that Democrats would feel like I'm a bad human if I don't vote for this for political reasons because I'm hurting individuals. I mean, if you had immigrants saying, hey, here's an immigration compromise that's going to legalize 10 million people and keep families together. It's short of citizenship, but we're so scared of deportation. You got to do this. That's a hard vote for Democrats to walk away from. But of course, that vote would not get most a lot of Republicans. That's the kind of stuff that he would have to do to even remotely consider pulling up a bipartisan compromise.
He has to change the narrative, Cajun style.
All right, I got to run. Check out Matt's fine work at the Daily Beast, and of course his excellent podcast, Matt Lewis in the News. If you haven't already, I wrote about the prospect of Oprah 2020 over at Politico this week. Don't hate me. Read it anyway. And we should have a new episode of my podcast, This Is Not Normal, up later this weekend. Anything else you got to mention?
No, man. Good to have you back. Good to be back. And we'll see you here next week in the DMV.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.